still be hurt. These organizations promised them a kind of enlightenment that would carry them successfully through life, would add to prosperity, would make them successful in business, add a little wealth here and there, overcome all the debilities of character, and perhaps even the debilities of health. One of the most pathetic of these cases is one in which I visited the hospital to spend a few moments, the last moments, with a person who all over a period of years had known that the particular doctrine that they followed would permit them to live without death, and then they found themselves dying. The promise was, of course, a vacancy. It was not possible. But the disillusionment was incredible. The person had believed that immortality rested in the revelation of a secret technique to do something. And they had practiced the technique for half a lifetime or more, and nothing happened. This is part of the problem of nearly all organizations that do not emphasize that no individual can know more than he is. No bottle can be more than full. And when the individual is full of himself, there's no room for anything else. And this is mostly our problem. When we spend all of our time thinking about what we want, we have little time to meditate upon what we need. And that was one of the theories behind Pythagorean philosophy. He warned his disciples in their meditations never to ask God for favors, because in order to do so, they would have to let deity know where they were, and this would be a mistake. But in any event, the principle involved is that everywhere, true growth is a transmutation. It is a transforming of base elements into spiritual growth, gold. And there are three different ways in which the ancients advanced this subject. The most simple way that they knew was to live according to the virtues of our own spirits and our own hearts. In other words, supposing we are addicted seriously to the Ten Commandments, and that is the basis of our religion. Now, the Ten Commandments remains an important code or credo. But the individual who doesn't keep them gains nothing because he has memorized them. Nor does he gain anything because he preaches them. The point is he in his own simple way keeping them? If knowing what is right, we practice that which is right, we grow. And this growth is real. But if knowing what is right, we fail to practice what is right, then what may appear to be growth for a moment is not, and we are ultimately confounded by our own mistakes. So everywhere, the beginning to the ancients was the practice of the common natural virtues of living, the correction of dispositional tendencies, the maintenance of a happy and properly regulated home, due attention and affection to family, children, respect for parents, and moderation of living, and a certain humility towards life, a lack of arrogance, a lack of dictatorial domination, and a freedom from the aggrandizement of self. These things are the common virtues of life. And if they are more or less assiduously practiced, then the individual is beginning to release spiritual value within himself. Now, the second way in which he can accomplish this purpose depends entirely upon the first. The first virtue is a cathartic virtue. That is, it is a cleansing. And the individual who doesn't cleanse his heart and mind of his common mistakes will go no further. He can never hurdle over them. He can never say, the Lord will forgive my disposition because I can't control it. That is not a problem, because the Lord that must live with the disposition is in you and suffers from your disposition every day. It is not a separate power, but is part of your own consciousness. Then, after you have had a certain cathartic discipline, where you have cleansed and purified your heart and mind as far as possible from the ordinary mistakes of living, then the ancients declared it became necessary to gain control of both the mind and the emotions. The first step was to cleanse them so that they did no harm. The second was to control them so that they could be used constantly and consciously for the attainment of the purposes for which they were intended. The mind is given to the individual to think with, and the quality of his thinking is something he must control. It is necessary for him to recognize his responsibility to use the mind for the advancement of himself and the general benefit of society. Unless he uses these faculties properly, they will not be expanded. We must be faithful into little things if we wish to become part of greater things. So in the emotions and the mind, the correction of small mistakes opens the way to great achievements. And the gradual disciplining of life means not only to be honest in the terms of the Ten Commandments, but to so change and discipline moods that temper will not escape from us, that our dispositions will not become acid with a few disappointments, or that we will become belligerent over the things that we do not believe. And one of the best and most important rules is to get over judging other people and assume the need for self-judgment, and that this self-judgment must not be dominated by egotism. So the person practices meditation, the Pythagorean disciplines. He goes into religious orders. He goes further and further into the search for spiritual integrities as they are dramatized in the rituals of the mysteries and the solemnities of the Mass. All of these things have a tendency to stimulate, to release, to inspire, and to encourage. Great music, great art, these release soul power. They release the use of energy from mediocre waste to well-directed purpose. Then in the third and highest step of discipline, there comes the quiet experience of the presence of God, the recognition and experience within self of the indwelling divinity, and that this experience becomes so continuous and so certain and so complete that the individual then walks together with the Lord at all times throughout life. And this achievement brings the person to the degree in which the leadership of the spirit within himself leads him back along the path to the center of life, the center in his own heart, and the center in the heart of space. The person has to earn these things. Evolution is this earning. Evolution is the discovery of the fact and gradually the strength to obey and fulfill this fact. Today with Christianity, we have great needs. We have very great needs for a mystic Christian revelation. It is coming. There are a number of groups arising who are recognizing that Christianity is not a problem for theology. Christianity is a problem of human regeneration through conscious effort. Christianity will remain inept in its management of world affairs so long as it counts upon its numerical strength or upon its traditional privileges. But the power of Christianity must be the power to transform the weaknesses of human nature, the conflicts of social order, and all these destructive misunderstandings by the light of the availability of the power of truth. To the average Christian mystic, to most Christian mystics, and to many others of other faiths, the Christ represents primarily the perfect enlightenment of the human soul. The Christ principle is, in a sense, the presence of the divine in each living thing. It is present even in the smallest creature that lives, but in man it is the symbol of the perfect achievement in life. The story is partly, undoubtedly, biographical, and it is partly symbolical. It is part of the great mystery ritual that has descended for the regeneration of man and has been present in every religion in the world. The Christened person is the one who has turned the control of life over to the Christ principle within himself. And this principle stands for all that is good. And it stands for the possibility, in fact the reality, of the gradual release of the Christ principle through our own composite natures. And this, according to the mystics, was the second coming. It was the coming of the Christ principle in our daily conduct, the gradual regeneration and reformation of our own life and the way we live it and the things that we do every day. Now, as we gather again for Christmas, and we are very close to that time now, we should have some thought for these values that we have a tendency to accept but do not actually apply. We've never had a greater opportunity than today to make the Christian religion a fact in our daily life. But this fact is not in terms of architecture. It is not in terms of the constant repetition of words which have comparatively slight meaning for us. We believe in them. We hope that they are all true. Some of these words are implying the danger to the soul if we don't keep them, and others the glories of the soul if we do keep them. But the real fact remains that the Christ person, the Christian, is the person who has been christened. And to be christened, it means in essential to be dedicated to the revelation of the God power within himself. Now, we can say that's fine, but how do we do it? What do we do in cases like this? How are we going to apply our daily conduct to fulfill so exalted a concept? I think the first thing we have to try to do is to get a concept of this. If we can really finally come to realize that salvation is within, and we have much evidence to support it, because if you look around you in the world, you see that so-called salvation from the outside is not working. It never could. Salvation is a result of accepting something but doing nothing about it is simply a fallacy. I remember growing up, I was in an area where there were a number of annual evangelists that came down through the small towns and converted people. And it was really quite an interesting and inspiring spectacle. And maybe 200 or 300 of the town people saw the glory and were converted. But the minister, one of them, told me later, he said it was necessary to come back every year and reconvert them. Because nothing of that nature, these high notions maintained by an emotional ecstasy, seldom would last for more than 12 months. By that time, the alcoholic was back on the bottle and the unpleasant parent was back making his family miserable. So it was necessary to convert about every year. And anything that approaches religion on the basis of conversion is on this problem. It will not help. The only answer has to be that the individual, recognizing that he has the capacity, because of the divine principle within him, to be anything that he will be by dedication. But that if by any chance he wants to use this divine principle for selfish ends, he is then a first-class Satanist. Because to use God for less than his own purposes must be considered as treason. But if the individual slowly and cautiously and carefully does allow growth to take place, permits himself to cling to principles, to weigh all things, and every day try to see or experience some proof of a truth or an ideal which he should be applying. If he will do this, he will not make a great change in history, but he may make a great change in himself. He will begin to realize that we can be defeated simply by lack of right motive, that we can come to nothing because we have not placed our goal where it belongs. The end of our life is not that we should be rich, powerful, distinguished, or have a wide sphere of influence. The end of our life is not that we should convert everybody else to what we believe. The end of living is to grow in grace, grow in spirit, grow within ourselves, not by our own effort, but by the presence of a power within ourselves. And this brings us a little bit into the problem of the Christ and the Antichrist. The individual is starting in to grow, really sincerely trying, begins to experience interferences. He begins to be tempted to compromise just a little, or to point out a certain temper fit and justify it on the grounds of righteous indignation. Also, if he's a little less than honest, it probably will be overlooked because the rest of the world is a little less than honest. These things arise from what the Greeks call the ego, the personal self. And this personal self is the prince of this world who has nothing in God. But the temptation to be less than ourselves arises from the mental process by means of which we visualize the pleasure of doing something that is not proper, or that we do not believe sufficiently in the integrities to allow them to stand against the appetites or the temptations. So we have to watch very carefully as we go along to see that we do not slip a little, as they used to say in the old days down by the river, we would not become a backslider. The backslider is one who goes two steps forward and three backwards in the development of his moral nature. Temptations become more and more prominent, more and more pressing. And the moment we begin to practice them or accept them, they increase in strength and power until finally they block practically every effort of the individual to release the best of himself. Even in the arts, this is true, because the temptation of wealth or success in art generally destroys the integrity of art. And every compromise that we make of values reduces our probability of achieving that which we most need and desire. This does not mean that the good life, the religious life, is one of frustration. The whole idea that we have to give up, inhibit, or restrict, deny ourselves of everything we want in order to be good is completely untrue. If we have to deny ourselves everything because it interferes, or these things interfere with goodness, then there's something wrong with the things we like. We should realize that if the fulfillment of desire requires a compromise of character, then there's something wrong with the desire, and that this is the problem. There are things we want which we should not have. There are things we want to do that we should not do. But if our personal feelings are strong enough to make us do these things, then we are in the presence of the tempter. The tempter is nothing more or less than the human ego, the mind, telling us that we can get away with a little larceny occasionally. And we cannot. The principles within the individual are so exact that they are like the motion of atoms or molecules or electrons. Everything is exact. There are no approximates. There are no try it over again attitudes. Everything has to be what it should be. The development of integrity is an exact science, but it is not a frustration. an individual who will spend 20 years, perhaps, practicing 5 hours a day to become a violinist does not seem to begrudge the effort. If he's a real musician, it will be because he loves music. If he is a technician without the deeper side of his art, then he will be glad to do it for the sake of the fees that he can collect. But he does it. And as a result of that, he becomes an expert. And because he becomes an expert, he becomes famous. And so on and so on and so on. Now, a person who is willing to do all this for the sake of playing a violin should not believe it to be a terrible hardship to practice the integrities or to practice the presence of God in his own life. The only reason why he is inclined to doubt it is because the musician thinks he has a little business lying ahead, whereas the practice of the virtues seems to be only rewarded in heaven, and many people who are looking for rewards here and now. But the problem remains that the moment we depart from the realities, we fall into the slough of despond, as it is called in Pilgrim's Progress. So the person has to decide to try. We won't be perfect at it. No one will. To try as far as possible, when we think of our faith, to think of living it. Now, we have a very difficult year probably coming up. It's not going to be as easy by any means in these times for the individual to live what he believes. He will be forced by circumstances to compromise, or thinks he is forced. He should, however, very carefully weigh the temptations and the motivations for the attitudes that he may take in these emergencies. He must try to prove to himself first that he is sincere, that he is not trying to find a way out of trouble. He is trying to find a way of learning more about life. The eternal principles of things have settled this world as a training establishment for the graduation of souls. As the Rosicrucians say, this is the abecedarian for the education of children studying in the school of the Holy Spirit. This is what, in sense, it is. We are all here to learn how to live. And it's a long and difficult job. But in the course of it, we will finally come to the realization that doing the best job possible makes the best life possible, and also the easiest way of getting to the goals that we want. So as we come to Christmas, we have to be very careful in our thinking. Today, most people are much disillusioned at Christmas. They feel that the entire situation is highly extravagant and is commercialized, and that most persons face it half-heartedly. Well, that may all be true, but no matter what any other person does, Christmas to you must always be what it does for you or what it does to you. And this is the important thing. Anything that Christmas brings out of you in the form of graciousness, kindness, thoughtfulness, gentleness, these virtues, anything that Christmas inspires you to achieve in those areas is well worth whatever it costs. That which enables you to gradually dismiss it all and live with yourself is almost certainly a matter of self-centeredness and lack of spiritual insight. It is very important that in these times that we try to do that which is the most gracious and the most kindly. Now, this does not mean that we have to be extravagant. It does mean, however, that we must, over the Christmas season perhaps especially, stop judging people, stop criticizing them, and try to discover, if possible, the constructive relationship between ourselves and these other people. If somebody so commits an action that it provides us with an opportunity for forgiveness, that we can forgive them, the forgiving of them is a greater good to us than the injury could possibly have been a harm to us. If wherever we become better, wherever we show higher indications of our own integrities, we grow and become more vital and move toward that desired end. Now, with Christmas coming again, we want to see family, we want to see friends, we want to make as much of it as we can. We do not want Christmas to be simply a spending spree. No one wants that. On the other hand, I've talked to some people who object to Christmas as a spending spree, and you'd be surprised what their explanation is. One person told me that he didn't believe in buying Christmas presents because he believed in spending his money on himself. Now, this is a thought. Now, it might possibly be, if you dig a little bit into it, there might be a trace of ulterior motive in this attitude that we have. Another individual will say, well, I'm not going to send anything to the Joneses because I sent them something last year and what they sent me wasn't worth anything. This is another justification for nothing. These things are the false attitudes upon this proposition. Then the idea that we want to get rid of it because it's become a merchant's holiday, we must remember that if we do get rid of it, we are probably placing another nail in the coffin of Christianity. It's not to get rid of it, it is to do the right thing with it that is important. We should never give up anything which inspires. We should never give up any occasion which makes it possible for us to unite in fellowship and in understanding and in cheerful union for common good. We must try to protect these values regardless, and every effort to get out of them because they interfere, because they are money wasters or time wasters. This type of thinking is negative and is simply adding to the unreligious majority of mankind. On the other hand, to make something good out of Christmas is an achievement. It brings something with it that is valuable. It helps us perhaps to remember the forlorn and the forgotten. I know of cases where a Christmas card is the only thing some people have sent to their relatives once a year for the last 20 years. And if by some chance the relative doesn't send them one, the next year they don't send the relative one. This is not Christianity. This is carefully considered problem of what is the greatest advantage or the least trouble to ourselves. So this year, whatever it is, let's try to do something to keep the spirit of this thing alive. If you have your religious groups, attend them. Go and share them with them in music and in some simple religious belief. Some people don't go to these religious places because they think they're too elementary. The message is not exalted enough. But it isn't a matter of how exalted or not it is. It's whether or not it helps people in the various levels of life where they live. We're not all living on the same level, but we must all strive in one way or another to understand the levels on which other people live, and at the same time understand why we've got to raise our own occasionally if we really want to get somewhere. So whatever it is, use a certain amount of festivity. And do not spend too much time regretting world conditions. After all, we caused them. And whether we like it or not, we're going to have to pay for them ultimately. The world conditions did not descend as it falleth from heaven. It came right out of our daily relationships with each other. And these conditions will not be cured until a better part of ourselves leads the rest of ourselves. And I think it was Marcus Aurelius who said on one occasion, a man is a little flesh and a little air, and that which commands. And that is what we all are. We're just mind, body, little air, but that which commands. Marcus Aurelius was a mystic. That which commands is the best part of ourselves. And when the best leads the rest, growth is inevitable. But when we block the best and strive desperately to escape the challenge of self-improvement, we are in serious trouble. So we're going to have some difficulties in the coming years. The world is very much upset. But I think we have to realize that as citizens of the universe, each of us has his own responsibility. Each of us must do that which he sees it, and the best as he knows, for the God of things as they are. Each of us must try to be prepared for the changes that arise. We must be prepared for the tragedies that may come. But if we have inward security in principles, if we have turned our destiny over to the highest part of ourselves, whatever happens, we can handle. Whatever happens, we can be true to truth. And that is all that anyone can be expected to achieve. But there is another byproduct that is very important. And that is, as we do improve, as we do gain control of our own weaknesses, there comes into us a peace that surpasseth understanding. The fears, the doubts, the anxieties, the uncertainties, that questioning as to whether there is a God or not, these negatives fade away if the individual makes the achievement of inner integration. If the best of us leads the rest, we will live our lives as they should be lived. We will face changes as they should be faced. And regardless of what happens, we will realize that when we keep the truth keeps us. And when we are true to the God in ourselves, we cannot be untrue to that divine power which abides in space. For we are part of space. And in our keeping is the condition of space. For space is nothing but all that lives added up. And when we add our little bit, and that little addition is right, space is the wiser and the richer. And I hope all of us will be able to make this coming Christmas a little bit special. Most of us have tried and are studying and are working. We feel the best we can. Perhaps we are, perhaps we are not. But we really want to grow. We want to be better people. We want to be wiser servants to those who need. We want to make a happier world. And most of all, we want to bring the human pattern, the human tragedy, back again into the nature of the divine power. We want the peace to come that is permanent, the peace of man's perfect adjustment with the infinite good. We're not going to make it overnight, but in time, with effort, we'll get there. In the meantime, every kind word and every thoughtful deed is a step in the right direction. And salvation begins with a single step. And maybe each one of us in a New Year's resolution or in a Christmas dedication will make one more step in the direction of that power which is locked within us, and release from within ourselves the divine prisoner that has been held in bondage by the weaknesses of our own dispositions. I think if we can think things through a little bit in this way, it may make us a little happier for Christmas. And at this time, I want to wish all of you a very happy and wonderful Christmas and a happy, thoughtful, inspiring, and progressive New Year. May the New Year bring each of us closer to the God within and the God in eternity. Thank you.
I'm not sure what I'm doing.